On this 20th day of September 2006, we are reading from the Srimad Bhagavad Gita as it is, translation commentary by His Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. Chapter 2, the contents of the Gita summarized. Text number 223. Nainam chintanti shastrani.
Nainam chintanti shastrani.
Nainam dahati pavakah.
Nainam dahati pavakah.
Nachainam kledi yantyapo.
Nachainam kledi yantyapo.
Nashoshiyati marutah. The soul can never be cut to pieces by any weapon, nor burned by fire, nor moistened by water, nor withered by the wind. Purport, all kinds of weapons, swords, flame weapons, rain weapons, tornado weapons, etc., are unable to kill the spirit soul. It appears that there were many kinds of weapons made of earth, water, air, ether, etc., in addition to the modern weapons of fire. Even the nuclear weapons of the modern age are classified as fire weapons, but formerly there were other weapons made of all different types of material elements. Fire weapons were counteracted by water weapons, which are now unknown to modern science. Nor do modern scientists have knowledge of tornado weapons. Nonetheless, the soul can never be cut into pieces. Nonetheless, the soul can never be cut into pieces nor annihilated by any number of weapons, regardless of scientific devices. The Mayavadi cannot explain how the individual soul came into existence simply by ignorance and consequently became covered by the illusory energy. Nor was it ever possible to cut the individual souls from the original Supreme Soul. Rather, the individual souls are eternally separated parts of the Supreme Soul. Because they are atomic individual souls, eternally, sanatan, they are prone to be covered by the illusory energy. And thus they become separated from the association of the Supreme Lord, just as the sparks of a fire, although one in quality with the fire, are prone to be extinguished when out of the fire. In the Varaha Purana, the living entities are described as separated parts and parcels of the Supreme. They are eternally so, according to the Bhagavad Gita also. So, even after being liberated from illusion, the living entity remains a separate identity, as is evident from the teachings of the Lord to Arjuna. Arjuna became liberated by the knowledge received from Krishna, but he never became one with Krishna. Om Ajnanatmarandhasya Gyananjani Shalakaya Chakshurun Minatam Mena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha. I was born in the darkness of ignorance. My spiritual master, Srila Prabhupada, opened my eyes with the torchlight of knowledge. I offer my humble obeisances unto him and all members of Sri Parampara. So this is hammering home different qualities of the soul on the negative side. In other words, these are all things that cannot happen to the soul, cannot be cut, cannot be burned, cannot be blown around, cannot be drowned, cannot be poisoned, cannot any other way you want to try to think of how a human body can be destroyed, it doesn't affect the soul. Because the soul is of a categorically different nature. It is said, what is that? Vishnu Shakti Para Prokta Chetra Gyakya Tatha Para Abhidhya Karma Sanganya Tritiya Shaktir Ishyate. In this verse, it's described that the Vishnu Shakti is transcendental. This is referring to the internal energy of the Lord, which is manifested in the spiritual world as the pleasure potency, ladini, existence potency, sandini, and knowledge potency, sambit. Chetra gyake tatha para, the knower of the field of the body, is also part of that para shakti, as explained in the 7th chapter also. But because we're minute, we have a tendency to be covered by avidya. Avidya karma sangyanya. There's another shakti called avidya, which induces the living entity to engage in karmic activities. Tritiya Shaktirishyade, these are the three basic categories of Krishna's energy. So this weapons, as we know them, can only act on the material plane. They can destroy the body, they can burn it, they can cut it apart, do all sorts of horrible things to it. But the soul remains unscathed. So this is by way of trying to induce Arjun to realize that he's not really going to be killing anybody. Even though he may destroy the bodies of the enemy, still their souls will continue. And so provided that he's doing so on the basis of Krishna's instruction, there will be no sinful reaction for him, and indeed everyone will be benefited because they'll be killed in the presence of the Lord and so get liberation. So Prabhupada refers here to the Mayavadis. This idea of cutting, their idea is that that Brahman actually gets cut off into little pieces, the Supreme Brahman, and that's us. And then we're covered by avidya, and so the illusion is that we're different. The illusion is that we're different from the Supreme. When that illusion is destroyed through the cultivation of knowledge, then we merge back into the Supreme and become the Supreme Brahman. But Prabhupada, he's referring here when he says, because they are atomic individual souls, eternally sanatan, he's referring to the verse in the 15th chapter, 15:7, where Krishna says, mamaivangsho jivaloki jivabhuta sanatana. The living entities in this conditioned world are my eternal fragmental parts. And in this purport, Prabhupada knocks home the argument that we are eternally part and parcel. And also we learned in this chapter, back in text 12, natvevaham jatu nasam natvam neme janadipa. Never was there a time when I did not exist, nor you, nor all these kings, nor in the future shall any ever cease to be. And Prabhupada, in this purport, following the previous commentators, describes this as a direct challenge to the Mayavadis, because what's the point of saying that all these kings existed before and they existed now and they exist in the future if they're really only just going to merge into the Supreme? There's no point in it. So that that verse also talks about the individual existence of the souls. So this verse is repeated actually in text 24 in summary, and he gives even more qualities. So any discussion on these important qualities of the soul, that we cannot be damaged by any material activity. So, achedyo yam adayo yam akledyo shosha eva cha nityak sabakatak stanur achaloyang sanatana. This individual soul is unbreakable and insoluble and can be neither burned nor dried. He is everlasting, present everywhere, unchangeable, immovable, and eternally the same. All these qualifications of the atomic soul definitely prove that the individual soul is eternally the atomic particle of the spirit whole, and he remains the same atom eternally without change. The theory of monism is very difficult to apply in this case because the individual soul is never expected to become one homogeneously. After liberation from material contamination, the atomic soul may prefer to remain as a spiritual spark in the effulgent rays of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. But the intelligent souls enter into the spiritual planets to associate with the Personality of Godhead. The word sarvagata, all-pervading, is significant because there is no doubt that living entities are all over God's creation. They live on the land, in the water, in the air, within the earth, and even within fire. The belief that they are sterilized in fire is not acceptable, because it is clearly stated here that the soul cannot be burned by fire. Therefore, there is no doubt that there are living entities also in the sun planet with suitable bodies to live there. If the sun globe is uninhabited, then the word sarvagata, living everywhere, becomes meaningless. So sarvagata, you know, all-pervading, it doesn't mean that each individual soul is all-pervading. We pervade our individual bodies, but it means that they go everywhere. I remember some time ago, this is going back 10, 15 years now, it became, they discovered that in these, deep within the ocean, you hear me? Deep within the ocean, they have these volcanoes, or volcanic vents, that are giving off hot gases way below the ocean. And these are superheated, because down there, the water pressure keeps the water from turning into steam and things. So it's just very, very, very hot water, much hotter than boiling water here. And they made the astounding discovery that there's little, you know, germs in there. There's little organisms in those hot vents. And they couldn't figure out how this could possibly be, because they had this idea that above a certain temperature, nothing could live. So this expanded their, you know, the scientists' horizons of what could be a compatible environment for life. But in truth, everything is a compatible environment for life. It's simply the different kinds of bodies. We have bodies that are suitable for this environment, and even, you know, specifically sea level or a little bit above, you know. But some birds can fly, practically, you know, miles up into the air. And we couldn't possibly go that high. We couldn't breathe up there, whatever. But it's also true that, you know, there are subtle bodies that are made of more of ether, the percentage of different. The percentage of water and air and ether and earth is different in these different bodies. And so even in the sun, we are told, there are bodies made mostly of fire, and they're living very nicely there. Just as down in the ocean, fish are living nicely. They don't even know anything about water. They never heard about water. You know, just like when you're living in this, you don't think, oh, I'm living in air. It's just your environment, you know. So therefore, there's Sarvagata. And this Stanur, Achaloyam Sanatana. So the living entity never moves from his constitutional position, really. In the 13th chapter, it will be specifically stated that the soul never mixes with the body, even though we're pervading the body, if you will, as explained earlier. But we don't mix with the body. But because our consciousness is identified with matter, we seem to be totally wrapped up in the affairs of this body. You look at the body as simply a means by which the soul can interact with matter. Very complicated machine. We're floating in these different kinds of air around the heart, and then there's a means by which the consciousness can be expressed through a brain. You know, the mind can be expressed through a brain, and we know ourselves through the you know that mechanism. If the brain gets damaged, we may not be able to see or smell or taste or hear anymore, or maybe even think, you know. So it's the mind, it becomes constricted, intelligence becomes constricted. But that happens all the time. We can see the lower animals, they're living at a very rudimentary plane, you know, and then you go even lower to insects, you know. There's a mind there, but it's like practically all instinctual. So it's just because the mechanism isn't there. The machine by which the soul can know itself and know the world is very constricted. So human life is, you know, we say, a higher state of evolution of the soul. Prabhupada uses that term, evolution. Not that the forms are evolving. Forms are always there, like different apartments. But the soul goes through them and evolves in the sense of expands, more and more of its consciousness. So the mission of the human life is to complete the process of evolution, to really attain that state of superconsciousness, another term Prabhupada used in the third canto, superconsciousness. In other words, to break out of the bonds of the material tabernacle that we've been inhabiting. So, therefore, the soul, but the soul, whether in the body of Brahma or in the body of an ant, is stano. He's fixed and he's unchangeable. And I was explaining yesterday about being immovable. This is a paradox. This is one of those koan-type statements that it's hard to fathom how we don't move. Since we're going from body to body and planet to planet, so how don't we move? Because the soul, as a spirit, does not move or undergo any change. There's no time, there's no actual geography by which the soul goes anywhere. But because we are identifying with different elements, the death really means that we stop identifying with this body, we start identifying with another body. That's the meaning of death. And we forget. We forget the previous body and we start identifying with a new body. There's an intermediary period where we're unconscious. And then we start identifying with a new body, and that's how it goes. But we're really not going anywhere, and therefore we're achala. The final process is to attain that body that we don't have to change. In other words, to reawaken into our spiritual body, where we have spiritual senses, spiritual mind, spiritual intelligence, and there's no more change. There's no more change of identification. That is our final resting place, our final identity in relation to Krishna. It's called the Siddhadeya, the body of perfection, or the Swarup Siddhi, the perfection of one's real form and function in relation to Krishna. Okay, any questions on these statements? Moving along, text 25. Avyaktoyam, achintoyam, avikaryoyam uchite, tasmat evam viditvainam, nanu shojitamarasi. It is said that the soul is invisible, inconceivable, and immutable. Knowing this, you should not grieve for the body. As described previously, the magnitude of the soul is so small for our material calculation that he cannot be seen even by the most powerful microscope. Therefore, he's invisible. As far as the soul's existence is concerned, no one can establish his existence experimentally beyond the proof of Shruti or Vedic wisdom. We have to accept this truth because there is no other source of understanding the existence of the soul, although it is a fact by perception. There are many things we have to accept solely on grounds of superior authority. No one can deny the existence of his father based upon the authority of his mother. There is no source of understanding the identity of the father except by the authority of the mother. Similarly, there is no source of understanding the soul except by studying the Vedas. In other words, the soul is inconceivable by human experimental knowledge. The soul is consciousness and conscious. Now that's another interesting statement. The soul is consciousness and conscious. That also is the statement of the Vedas, and we have to accept that. Unlike the bodily changes, there is no change in the soul. As eternally unchangeable, the soul remains atomic in comparison to the infinite supreme soul. The supreme soul is infinite, and the atomic soul is infinitesimal. Therefore, the infinitesimal soul, being unchangeable, can never become equal to the infinite soul or the supreme personality of Godhead. This concept is repeated in the Vedas in different ways just to confirm the stability of the conception of the soul. Repetition of something is necessary in order that we understand the matter thoroughly without error. So, although Prabhupada makes the point here, and of course he's correct, that ultimately to understand the soul we need to accept the authority of Shruti, the authority of infallible Vedic wisdom coming through Shastra and other sources, basically through Shastra. Still, there are some indications of the soul that Prabhupada would use that we can surmise. In other words, you have a certain set of data that you see. And what best explains it? For instance, why is it that people are born in such varied circumstances? That there is one child will be born in with the proverbial silver spoon in his mouth. Another child will be born into difficult economic circumstances and or with some congenital disease or whatever. So there's two possibilities. One is that everything is moving by chance, and that is just a throw of the dice. And the other is that there's some cause, some intelligent cause behind it. So the only explanation, this of course goes to the question of the traditional problem of evil, if there is a higher intelligence there, and he's using some kind of logic or system of justice, then why would he do that to seemingly innocent little children? Put one in a good circumstance, one in this trouble from day one. And the answer is that nobody's innocent, is that that there is a history to this living being that we see get born. It doesn't begin when they come out of the womb, but it has a long, long history that we can't see. So this is one reason, it's not a conclusive reason, but it's one piece of evidence to suggesting reincarnation. There are many others. The by now famous experiences of near-death experiences of people who are in the hospital and almost die. And the machines say you're practically flatlining, you're totally unconscious, the organs aren't working. And yet, a certain percentage, get revived from there. And some of those can describe the activities that took place while they were supposedly unconscious. This is a good indication that has only makes sense if there is a conscious entity that it can exist beyond the limitations of the body. There are some instances of hypnotic regression or just spontaneous remembrance of facts from previous lives that turn out to be true. This fellow Ian Stevenson did some very scientific investigation. I don't know if he's still alive now. But he wrote a book or books that describe his investigations of certain children, many of them in India, some in other countries, who claimed that they knew things from previous life. And he went there and checked in some town or village some way away that they had never visited. And sure enough, these facts checked out. So he went through, he said, well, what can explain it? What can explain it? Did the parents, you know, brief them or what? Yeah.
Girl at work said her son, when he was like 4 or 5 years old, would talk about different places and everything that he's been.
Yeah.
He also insisted on being a vegetarian.
Yeah, there you go.
When he was a young kid, he didn't know from nothing all these places.
Right there. There's a perfect example. You see? You know, so he had this book entitled So Many Investigations Indicative of the Existence of the Transmigration. Transmigration only makes sense with the existence of the soul. So even though the soul is invisible, certainly, and inconceivable because it can't be seen or heard or touched, still it makes sense logically to investigate the hypothesis that there is a soul based on certain empirical data. Now, the result of this, then he comes to the conclusion, tasmat. So this tasmat carries over for all of these other verses also, that the soul cannot be burned, dried, moistened, or blown away, or cut. Is unchangeable, invincible, you know, cannot be. Therefore, don't lament. You know, this is all part of the same argument. Do not lament. And you see that this injunction not to lament is really kind of a theme here. The very end of the Gita also, he says, don't lament. Sarva dharma paritya jamame kang sharanam vajaham tvam salvapapi moksha yasyami mashucha. Don't lament, Arjuna. You will not be covered by sin. You will not perform an act that harms anybody. This is for the good of the world, and even for the good of those who are killed. Therefore, don't lament. You have no reason to lament. You do not deserve to lament. And it's not becoming. You know, lamentation never helps anything. If you have some trouble that you're in that you have to figure out, it never does any good to just lament about it. The only good can be to apply your intelligence to remain calm and focused. So this lamenting and hankering, this is a symptom of one deeply in the modes of nature. And we'll find that one who is advanced in devotion becomes Brahma Bhuta, and that's one of the first symptoms, Nashochati and Nakanchati. No lamenting. Okay, let's see what else. So this is coming to the point also, Prabhupada makes the point of the need to accept the authority of the Shastra. Ultimately, you know, just the existence of the soul, that's just the A of the ABCs. You know, you certainly cannot come to the understanding of Krishna and the personality of Krishna through any kind of empirical means. We can intuit the need for a higher intelligence, although, you know, every day the popular culture is blasting away at the idea of intelligent design. Anyone who has half a brain can see that there's intelligent design everywhere. So if there's an intelligent design, there has to be an intelligent designer. This is one of the foundational proofs of the existence of God given by Thomas Aquinas in the Catholic tradition. And we use it all the time. But you can see that in the larger science of God, as is given by Bhagavad Gita, Srimad Bhagavatam, that's also very rudimentary. That's like the universal form, you know, to see God everywhere in the world because you see the hand of God, you see the body of the Lord. But to really develop a relationship with God requires all kinds of knowledge that can only come through the realized sources of revealed Shastra and realized souls. Okay, any discussion on these points? Yeah.
Is there anything similar to the soul?
I'm sorry?
Is there anything similar to the soul?
Yes. The super soul. Similar means what?
Like that it has all these qualities.
No, no. The soul is a category of energy completely separate from matter. So all of the qualities that we see in matter really don't belong to the soul. Although material form, you know, is a reflection, just like what is here can only be here because the reality is in the spiritual world. So similarly, our personality that we have, our senses, our activities, are shadows of the real activities of the soul. So in that sense, there is something like the soul. Yeah, I mean, you know, here we like to eat, you know, but it's a process that has limits. But there, in the spiritual world, we also eat, but the pleasure that comes from eating with Krishna on the bank of the Yamuna is far beyond what we can imagine here. Here we have picnics, we try to enjoy, but there are so many inebrieties, sometimes literally, people just drink beer until they can hardly drive. But there, you can have your picnic with Krishna, you know, every day.
Okay, so that's the fullness, and we're just partial.
This is, yeah, life here is a reflection, is a pale reflection. Perverted reflection.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, we'll do one more. Ata chainam nitya jatam nityam vaman nisem ratam tatapi tva mahabaho nainam shochitam arasi. If, however, you think that the soul or the symptoms of life will always be born and die forever, you still have no reason to lament, O mighty armed one. There is always a class of philosophers almost akin to the Buddhists who do not believe in the separate existence of the soul beyond the body. When Lord Krishna spoke the Bhagavad Gita, it appears that such philosophers existed, and they were known as the Lokayatikas and the Vaibhashikas. Such philosophers maintain that life symptoms take place at a certain mature condition of material combination. The modern material scientist and materialist philosophers also think similarly. According to them, the body is a combination of physical elements, and at a certain stage, the life symptoms develop by interaction of the physical and chemical elements. The science of anthropology is based on this philosophy. Currently, many pseudo-religions, now becoming fashionable in America, are also adhering to this philosophy. As are the nihilistic non-devotional Buddhist sects. Even if Arjuna did not believe in the existence of the soul, as in the Vaibhashika philosophy, there would still have been no cause for lamentation. No one laments the loss of a certain bulk of chemicals and stops discharging its prescribed duty. On the other hand, in modern science and scientific warfare, so many tons of chemicals are wasted for achieving victory over the enemy. According to the Vaibhashika philosophy, the so-called soul or atma vanishes along with the deterioration of the body. So in any case, whether Arjuna accepted the Vedic conclusion that there is an atomic soul, or he did not believe in the existence of the soul, he had no reason to lament. According to this theory, since there are so many living entities generating out of matter every moment, and so many of them are being vanquished every moment, there is no need to grieve for such incidents. If there were no rebirth for the soul, Arjuna had no reason to be afraid of being affected by sinful reactions due to his killing his grandfather and teacher. But at the same time, Krishna sarcastically addressed Arjuna as Mahabahu, mighty-armed, because he, Krishna at least, did not accept the theory of the Vaibhashikas, which leaves aside the Vedic wisdom. As a Kshatriya, Arjuna belonged to the Vedic culture, and it behooved him to continue to follow its principles. So here Krishna is giving a little side argument here that if Arjuna happened not to believe in the soul and just thought that bodies are just temporary conglomerations of chemicals, then he also had no need to lament. Of course, taken to the extreme, this nihilistic philosophy can excuse the greatest atrocities. You know, one can imagine the ideas or the mind, the mental construct of, you know, people who perform genocide or you know, who see slaves as just, you know, machines practically for doing work, that they're not really human beings. There's no empathy there because there's no soul. There's nothing that's going to live on. So this argument, of course, Krishna will not take it very far, because in the very next verse he says, Jata Sahi Duva Mrityu, whatever is born has to die, whatever is dead has to be born. But if Arjuna happened to have that idea, because, again, this is the kind of the critical factor, because the battle is desired by Krishna, still there would be no sin, even if he had that idea that there would be no soul afterward. So, you know, we should not for a moment adhere to this philosophy that human life is not just a conglomeration of chemicals. It's not that consciousness appears at a certain stage of chemical interaction. That's completely wrong. And indeed, we see that in the modern world, because they're going more and more toward that direction with pharmaceutical psychiatry, you know, it's so many different chemicals to try to just adjust your consciousness, raise your mood, put you to sleep, you know, whatever. That the, you know, what's the idea behind it? Well, we completely can control, you know, consciousness and mental state. It's just a result of chemical reactions in the brain. So once we know just what chemical to put in there, we can create, you know, any state of consciousness. We don't adhere to that at all. That is a deep delusion. And it leads to truly atrocious activities. Because, I'll give you an example. I read that they have chemicals now, they have weapons now that, you know, you don't hear about, where they, because of the genetic, you know, they've decoded the human genome, you know, all the genes in the human body. There's thousands and thousands of them. They decoded that. So now they can create, say, corn seed. They'll give it to a certain country. And the people will plant it and they'll eat it. And that corn that they eat will affect the males such that they can't have children anymore. A whole race of people. But it won't affect others of a different race. Because a race means a certain gene in there, right? And so they can you know, wipe out a whole ethnicity in that way. They actually have weapons like that. So this is the, you know, we read about this in the 16th chapter. Horrible works meant for the destruction of mankind. This is the demonic mentality at work.
So that's real?
It's for real. Oh. They have that. They're working on it. They're constantly creating these things. The military. The military.
Ours?
Industrial, yes. Industrial complex. Military industrial complex. So many weapons they have that we have no idea. They actually have weapons that they can do macro changes in climate.
Oh, yeah.
You know, they can create big changes in the climate and create hurricanes here, drought over there, like that. You know, it's not perfect. It's so complicated. They can't, you know, control that completely. But they're working on it, you know. So, you know, there's no hope. There's no hope for mankind except Krishna consciousness. This is directly the opposite. This is the mentality of the big demons we read about. You know, they no regard for human life, no, just power, money, you know, like that. And that's happening today, unfortunately. Any final comments or questions? We're moving through this little lesson in the soul. I think we'll finish in a few days. Now tomorrow we may have a problem because Dharma Setu Prabhu is coming in at 7 o'clock to do a sacrifice here. And if we want to, we might be able to have the class in Siki's living room. We'll let you know. Stay tuned.
What about your living room?
My living room?
You used to have classes there.
I don't know. Anyway, stay tuned. I'll let
My
you
place
know.
Is just so small.
All glories to Srila Prabhupada.